This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Belinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
Brian Levinka.
Summer Iman.
And Glenn Holt. And on tonight's show, in our second hour, it's J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage. Tonight's the 10th anniversary show, featuring an interview with Holly Neer, and it's all about the women's music movement. But first, another iconic anniversary. It was 30 years ago, in 1978, that a movie called Word Is Out, Stories of Some of Our Lives startled audiences across the country when it appeared in movie theaters and on television. It was the first feature-length documentary about lesbian and gay identity made by gay filmmakers. One of the producers of the movie is with us tonight, Tracy Gehry, founder of Inspired Legacies, and Marion Luntz, of the Museum of Fine Arts Houston. Then at 9:30, it's News Wrap, a weekly news summary of events in the GLBT world, reporting tonight on the rejection by lawmakers in the states of Iowa, New Hampshire, and Maryland of measures to ban same-sex marriage. Followed by the regular feature segments from This Way Out, one of those feature reports being on a unique documentary film called Faith of the Abomination, about two lesbian ministers who infiltrate an Austin, Texas, evangelical megachurch. They pose as heterosexuals and in the course of their elaborate investigation, uncover a plan by the pastor to, guess what, swindle his congregation.
Oh, my God. Well, it's an anniversary show tonight. We've got so many things going on with J.D.'s 10th anniversary. A little bit over, 30 years ago, Word Is Out. Another really incredible thing, which I got to see last Saturday, was I, Barbara Jordan. It's playing at the Alley. If you want to see it, you have one chance to see it at Saturday morning at 10 a.m. I know that's sort of a strange time slot. I need to warn you that, number one, this is a show made for school children, because it's touring around the schools. Number two, it's only an hour, but it is incredibly impacted, wonderful show. And the Alley taking this out and teaching people, young kids, about who Barbara Jordan is, because most people probably don't remember who she was. The first black and the first woman to be elected to the Texas Senate. Strangely enough, in her class at the Senate was also Joe Wilson.
Yes.
From East Texas. And just a wonderful, wonderful, powerful show. And what was really great is they had the director, they had the writer there, and Barbara Jordan's sister was in the audience.
Oh, wow.
So it was very, very powerful. Tickets are very, very cheap. If you have a chance to see it, Saturday morning, 10 a.m. at the Alley, downtown Houston on Texas Avenue, go to their website and you can actually have to call for tickets to reserve them. As we're talking about anniversaries, this is also KPFT's 40th anniversary. This is the time we're asking you, this is our only chance for this winter pledge drive session here on KPFT to pledge to Queer Voices. We really try to bring you good programming, and just like we're going to be talking about this movie tonight, I'm really excited about seeing it this Friday at the Museum of Fine Arts. Imagine, a queer movie at the Museum of Fine Arts, which is not the first time this has happened, but it's a beautiful theater surrounded by, probably one of the best museums in the country, that we get to see stuff like that. It's going to be very reasonably priced. We're able to do this type of stuff, to talk about this stuff, the arts, the political, the cultural stuff that goes on in this community. We don't have a weekly newspaper here in Houston anymore, which is really unfortunate, that we are the ones that try to glue the community together with what we talk about, what we do on this show. We're asking you to pick up the phone at 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. It's really important that you call now and support this radio program.
You know, there's a lot to be talking about in the donating. It's enough that you're giving to the station and to this show, and as you're showing your support, but KPFT is donating 10% of of the monies in the pledge drive to several nonprofit organizations, Doctors Without Borders, Partners in Health, Multi-Ethnic Community Center, the MECC. So anyone that, we're giving away free gifts and along with your pledges, but if you pass on the free gift, the money that would have gone toward that free gift will then be donated to the Haiti Fund.
And Queer Voices is your gay sounding board. We try to provide value to the community by giving you the latest issues and events for the community. And we think that we do add value, but we want you to show that we are adding value by calling 713-526-KPFT or going online, kpft.org, and donating online. Easy to do.
Okay, so we want to get right into the show because we've got a lot of stuff to do. So one more time, we're asking you to pledge. Call at 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. You're listening to Queer Voices. Well, as you can see, KPFT,
we're having technical difficulties.
Needs a little bit of tweaking.
We need you to donate now to help us pay the bills.
Yes.
Well, if after you see the Barbara Jordan event on Saturday morning, in the evening at 7 p.m., there's a movie, Brother Outside, The Life of Bernard Rustin.
Oh.
And it's going to be at Resurrection MCC. It's a free performance. Resurrection MCC is at 2025 West 11th. And, put that in your repertoire of things to do coming up this Saturday.
All right, shall we try it one more time? Let's go. You're listening to Queer Voices.
Queer Voices.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, as we were talking a little bit earlier, in 1978, a groundbreaking film was made called Word Is Out, Stories of Some of Our Lives. And, Tracy, how did you get involved in this? Tracy Gehry, who is, among other things, Inspired Legacies, which we'll talk a little bit about in a little while. But you were in San Francisco at the time?
I was in San Francisco. I was in my early 20s. We actually, the film, I've heard about the film being made in 1975. And at the time, my brother was a filmmaker and had been producing a film called Pumping Iron, which was Arnold Schwarzenegger's first film.
Yeah, of course.
And, of course, with great fanfare, I went to the opening in, I think, 1975. And I thought, $700,000 they just spent on bodybuilding? Dear God, can't we put some money into something that speaks to our lives? I was gay. I'd been out only for about 2 or 3 years, and I said, there's got to be a film being made about gay people. And sure enough, in San Francisco, about a year before, a group had begun to make a film about gays and lesbians all over the country. So I got involved.
And nowadays, you can go out and buy for a couple thousand dollars a decent camcorder, but back then, there wasn't such a thing.
That's right. It was really difficult. First of all, the crew was varied in their experience. Several of them had made films before, but they were also really committed to diversity. And the crew called Mariposa Film Group was a work in process and a work in progress of training people how to use the equipment and training people how to work collectively. Peter was a very dynamic leader who later became called the director, but each member of the Mariposa Film Group was equally strong in making decisions and in really finding great people around the country that could be filmed. So over 250 interviews were done, and actually we got to witness the collective process in a brand new way.
Well, this somehow seems to parallel the women's music movement at that time, that they had to learn how to do it. There were non-professional people who figure out how to do it because they couldn't necessarily get help. So I guess filming back then was sort of like this, you know, sort of either union shop or company shop, probably even more so. So this was like an independent film when it wasn't really popular to do independent films.
That's right. And they had sought actually to get investors, which was also very unusual for grassroots community organization to decide, hey, let's get investors. And so a lot of people who are gay had never thought to put their money into a film. And when I came along, they'd raised about the first $40,000. And we knew that the expenses were going to be a lot more than that. So I both put money in myself. I was a young inheritor. And then sought to be, really today I would be called a co-producer. I sought to accompany the film through its opening and distribution over a two-year period. And we raised another $100,000, $150,000. So for $250,000, we actually really changed how America perceived gay people. And it was an incredibly rewarding experience, both the process and also getting it to New York and getting it in the Academy Awards as well.
How were people chosen to be in the film?
Very deliberate process. I mean, we've got someone who's going to be on a little later who will be able to tell you that, but they went all over the country. And first of all, they put ads in gay newspapers and saying, we're looking for people who are willing to be public about their story. And then, you know, spent time going to any number of about 20 different cities and doing short videos of several of them. Then the collective, really, the six key people who were in the collective of the Mariposa Film Group, reviewed all those videos, short videos, and chose selectively, and then went to people's homes. And it was really for the diversity of who's presented. If you look at the 26 stories, they are stories of some of our lives, and they've got everything from a Chicana couple sitting on a bed in a small house in New Mexico to an uptight business guy who's in New York City. So, you know, we wanted to show the spectrum of our wonderful diversity of our community. And, of course, today it would even be an even more broad spectrum.
Well, let's bring Veronica on. Veronica, are you with us? No? Okay. I thought we had
her. She was on, but I think we lost her for a second.
Okay.
I wanted to ask, what was the impact of the film at the time in the 70s?
1977. First of all, we opened it in New York, and we opened it at the Castro in December, early December of 1977. And one of the best things that we were able to do, and we all were using our credit cards all over the place, was that we tried to bring in every one of the people that was in the film.
Oh, wow.
And it was the first time many of them had seen the film. It was the first time many of them had ever been public about being gay. And so there's some beautiful shots that are of, you know, of all of them on the stage at the Castro. but the impact of the film was really far beyond that. It was on PBS several times. It did open in New York. There were some amazing things that happened. One was that a lot of people who were straight wanted to see the film, but they were afraid that if they were seen going into the film, that they'd be, that people would think they were gay. So at one point, the advertising agency, which Peter and I had hired in New York, we decided that we would do something very funny. We would say, we hear that many of you who are straight really want to see the film, and yet you're worried about people identifying you as gay. So we're going to hand out paper bags. And there was a picture in the ad of a paper bag with the eyes cut out. And the this was in about the third week of the film when the film was starting to decline. And, the, you know, we had another 3 weeks of just amazing run after that happened. So the impact, there were letters, really hundreds and thousands of letters that over the years Peter and the Mariposa Film Group got of people who said, I had no idea that I was not the only person in my community.
And so it basically, you had to take the film around the country.
Mm-hmm.
That's how things were done back then. I believe we have Veronica on with us now.
Yes, I'm here. I'm sorry that I missed some of what Tracy said. It sounded fascinating, Tracy.
Hi, Veronica. You were there.
I was there, but hi.
Hi.
Yeah.
Well, this is a very historical film, and why don't you give us a little background of how your role in the film?
My role in the film was as one of the six filmmakers. I came in early. We didn't all start exactly at the same moment, but Peter and I were very, very close friends from high school already, so we'd known each other about 15 years by the time we came together to make this film. I was in California on a film job, and before I left to go back to New York, Peter said, would you stick around for 2 weeks and look at some of the tapes that Nancy, his sister, and he were doing. Peter had an idea to talk to gay people about their lives and to do it on camera. And the initial phase was to do it on video, on sort of Porter Pack clunky video equipment. And he talked to friends and people in the community, and Nancy did the same. And then I sat down with them, which was going to be about 2 weeks of looking at tapes, and I never left. It was just a completely mesmerizing and extraordinary experience to hear from people and to be, I guess, in a certain way, a first member of a very small audience. And so I stayed on, and we decided, of course, that the film was eminently worthwhile, and we shifted from video to film. So of these 2 weeks of viewing, we chose eight characters, I believe, and we brought on Rob Epstein as an intern. He was a young 19-year-old, and Andrew Brown came on board. And then we filmed eight people and did a cut and showed that to the community. I don't know, Tracy, I missed some of what you said, so I don't know if you mentioned the fact that showing our work to the community, as it was called. We had screenings, invited people to come and look, and at one of those screenings was Lucy Massey Phoenix, who was also in the Bay Area visiting, and she saw that first cut, and she said, well, I have to be a part of this project. So she joined us, and it was really at that first screening of eight people that we realized that we were going to be representing the community, representing sort of the diversity and the identity, gay identity, for the first time. And that's when we understood that we had to expand our cast, expand our geographical range, and make a much larger film. So that's how we went from eight people to 26. Obviously, it took some time. We traveled across the country looking for subjects. We all got together and looked again for many weeks together at all the tapes that we'd gathered, and chose the final 26 people and went back and filmed.
Now, this film is going to be shown at the Museum of Fine Arts, which has been no stranger to our community, and showing films that you can't see anywhere else.
Thanks, Jack.
And introduce yourself.
Marion Luntz from the Museum Film Department. Hi, Veronica.
Hi, Marion.
We've been emailing. Let me tell people when it's showing. And this is the first Houston screening of the restored print, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. But it will be this Friday, the 19th of February at 7 p.m. at the MFAH Brown Auditorium Theater. 350 seats, and we encourage people to get their tickets in advance.
Now, what do you mean by the restored print?
This is, Veronica, do you want to talk about this?
Sure, of course.
Okay.
Well, we shot in film, and that means we had a negative, and then we make a positive print. And over time, these things are delicate, and over time, the negative, which was our original, fades. It loses color, things happen to the sound, and it deteriorates. So to speak, and the film was chosen by a gay film organization, Outfest, which is a gay festival in L.A. that has a legacy project where they choose what they consider gay classics to be restored, and then they fundraise to get the monies to restore, and that's what they chose our film, Word Is Out, as a gay classic to be restored, which means they. Frame by frame, I mean, it's a very technical thing. Frame by frame, they regenerate the color and do all kinds of
wow.
things. And we had a wonderful donor for this. We had a man named David Bonnet, whose generosity, he's someone who, when he was 20, saw the film and claims, I think, very truthfully that it really changed his life. And he became, along the way, a very wealthy man, and he put in all the money for the restoration of the negative. And
yeah, I hear his name a lot on KCRW as a underwriter for them out in L.A.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
One of the things that's so great about the restoration and about this film, particularly at this moment, is that, you know, this film represented just a breakthrough at the time of the community getting to see itself, but also the whole country understanding what it was to actually be a gay person and to be a lesbian and to be in community. And so now, when in this time when we're so siloed and, you know, and sort of doing everything through text mail and email, you know, to make visible really what community was like. And, you know, in my part, I was really often just there in support of the crew and doing fundraising on the side, but also watching this incredible team of people work the collective and collaborative process, not only with each other, which was, you know, strum and drum. I mean, I have to tell you that, you know, my favorite memories were these six filmmakers and the team around them working day and night. I mean, really, you know, until 2 and 3 in the morning, which is, of course, true for a lot of artists. But also the process of going out and interviewing and finding community members who had never thought to be public, who'd had very private lives, and to see them through coming to the opening at the Castro, and to also see us embracing what is really making our private lives public, is a very, very beautiful statement. Here we are in Houston, where we have a mayor who's a great mayor and a lesbian, who, you know, and it represents such an amazing in these 30 years how the acceptance that has been found through this film in many ways. So I'm, you know, honored to be involved. I think we, at the time, we knew that we were doing something that I think we felt there was a moral imperative to do, which was to really, through love, compassion, and the showing of the humor of the film when you see it. Those of you who haven't seen it, run, do not walk to this showing, because there's so much compassion in the film. And joy.
I know we can go on for this for another 30 minutes because this is so interesting and it's so groundbreaking. When did it first get shown on PBS?
In 1978, in June of 1978, I think it was either June or October. I do want to say one quick thing, which is that coming up in the next few months, there will be a DVD release, because now that we have a new negative, we make a DVD. Maybe it was mentioned, and on the DVD, the extras will be interviews with a number of the subjects who 30 years later. So we have little interviews with them about where they are today and how it was for them to be in the film 30 years ago. So.
And of course, we've lost some people, including Peter, who, you know, Peter Adair. So it's, you know, it's amazing to see where people are now. We all can't wait to see that. And very grateful to the filmmakers for going that next step.
Tracy, I'm going to have you come back to talk again about Inspired Legacies because it's such a great organization. But I want to talk a little bit about the films that are shown at the Museum of Fine Arts.
Thanks, Jack.
How do you all choose the films? What is the significance of the films chosen?
Wow, I don't know if I can answer that in the time that we have, but as I hope most people know, we have a wonderful theater. We show films typically on weekend evenings throughout the year and just have a variety of community-oriented programs that we do. We are getting ready to collaborate with the Houston-Palestine Film Festival, be one of their venues in May. The Houston Jewish Film Festival in March. We just did an Iranian film festival that we do with Rice. And then we do a lot of films that we want people to see on the big screen. And I wanted to mention that this screening of Word is Out is part of a month-long festival of preservation from our friends at the UCLA Film and Television Archive. So starting the beginning of February, we've been showing these wonderful restored 35-millimeter prints of movies that they've restored for various reasons. And we've had a number of film noirs. We had John Cassavetes, Woman Under the Influence, who kicked off with it. And we have two films by John Sayles at the last weekend in February. We have The Brother from Another Planet and his first film, Return of the Secaucus 7. There's some silent films. And what we really want to do, and Tracy and I were talking about this earlier, is encourage people of all generations, our generation, younger and older, to remember what the experience is like of seeing films as they were intended to be seen on the big screen collectively and talk about it in a darkened theater, talk about it afterwards. And that definitely is what will happen with the screening of Word is Out. And I should also mention that we are planning to show additional screenings later in the spring. And
this is also in conjunction with Q-Fest, am I correct?
Right. Q-Fest is partnering on this, and Christian Salinas, who has been artistic director and curator for Q-Fest the past few years, will be introducing the screening.
Great. I'd like to thank you all for coming on and talking about this film. I mean, I'm just really want to go see it this Friday. This is a very important film. It's called Word is Out. What time's it at, and where's the theater located at?
It's at 7 o'clock, and it's the Museum of Fine Arts Houston, 1001 Bissonnette, between Montrose and Main. There should be plenty of free parking surface lot we have, and it's down in the lower level of the museum, and there's a nominal ticket charge.
I wish I were there.
Yes. You're listening to Queer Voices, and we are in fundraising mode right now, so we're asking you to call. Call us at 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. This is the only week we'll be on during this cycle of fundraising, so it's really important that you call now. You're listening to Queer Voices.
Don't tell me you adore her. All gay boys adore a mummy. You should see them at parties and openings. It's moss to a flame. To which Arthur responds, I knew I was no John Wayne, but was it that obvious?
I want our people to be able to go into a mainstream church and not hear that they're an abomination or they're of the devil or several different phrases the mainstream churches use. It's time for that to stop.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Mob violence arrests a gay Kenyan wedding, the hour between coming of age and adulthood, and undercover lesbian preachers infiltrate a homophobic megachurch. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Pam Marshall.
And I'm Rick Watts.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending February 13th, 2010. Five men were arrested in Kenya on February 12th in connection with what police called an illegal gay wedding in Umtwapa, a town just north of the coastal city of Mombasa. The ceremony was reportedly to be held at a private villa in the Kikambala Beach Resort, but police officers, prompted by a public outcry, raided a house where invited guests had been staying and arrested the men. Private consensual adult gay sex is illegal in the East African country and is punishable by up to 14 years in prison. District officer George Matandura said the couple that was to wed evaded police. He said that two of the five arrested men had wedding rings and that the three others were rescued by police from a mob that, according to the BBC, had already beaten two of them. The country's Daily Nation newspaper reported that hundreds in the angry crowd were baying for their blood and continued in noisy protest outside the police station. "We are grateful to the public for alerting the police," Matandura told reporters. "They should continue cooperating with the police to arrest more." He said such an unnatural offense is repugnant to the morality of the people. Matandura said the five men, who range in age from 20 to 35, will undergo a medical examination before we charge them with homosexuality. There were no suggestions in several media reports that any of the men were engaged in sexual activity when they were arrested. The participants had tried to keep the wedding secret, but several Muslim and Christian clergy heard about it and alerted their congregation several days earlier. Calling the police action Operation Gaze Out, Sheikh Ali Hussein of the Council of Imams and Preachers of Kenya told Agence France-Presse that we cannot allow these young boys to ruin their future through homosexuality. Bishop Lawrence Chai of the National Council of Churches of Kenya told the Daily Nation that we thank God for saving this town from being turned to Sodom and Gomorrah of this era. We may have been on the verge of being doomed. According to the BBC, two other men abandoned their plans to get married at a seaside villa in the same area and fled with their guests when word spread that the police and members of the public were looking for them.
Lesbian and gay rights have been a contentious topic elsewhere on the African continent in recent months. A widely reported anti-homosexuality bill that includes the death penalty in some cases for private consensual adult gay sex will soon be debated by Uganda's parliament. Police in Malawi arrested a gay couple for holding a public engagement party in late December, and their trial is set to resume shortly. Malawi's Deputy Information Minister, Kingsley Namakwa, said this week that, as far as his government is concerned, Stephen Mungeza and Tawange Chembalanga, who've been refused bail, are the only gays in the country. If there are others, he said, let them come out in the open. But he noted that any who did would be arrested under Malawi's laws, which punish gay sex with up to 14 years in prison. The Catch-22 statement also followed the arrest of a 21-year-old man for pasting "Gay rights are human rights" posters along the main streets in Malawi's largest city of Blantyre. Peter Sawali was convicted of conduct likely to cause a breach of the peace. According to the BBC, he was sentenced to community service, cleaning the premises of Blantyre Magistrates Court for 60 days. Police say they are still trying to track down others connected with what they call a gay rights campaign, some of whom they believe are foreigners who supplied Sawali with the posters.
Meanwhile, the European Parliament has warned three countries, Croatia, Macedonia, and Turkey, that they must offer genuine protection to sexual minorities before they can join the European Union. In reports given to the Europarliament about their records on LGBT rights, Croatia was criticized for its 2009 ban on Zagreb Pride and the government's failure to implement anti-discrimination laws. Turkey's penal code was criticized for allowing for the systematic persecution of LGBT people. In fact, an advocacy group in Izmir, Black-Pink Triangle, is being prosecuted and threatened with closure for violating Turkish moral values and family structure. Other LGBT groups in the country have faced similar charges in recent years. Lambda Istanbul won a lengthy court battle to avert closure last year. Macedonia was also urged to protect lesbians and gays in its anti-discrimination laws. But the government unveiled revised anti-discrimination legislation in late January that deleted sexual orientation as a protected category. Deputy Minister for Social Policy, Spiro Rostovsky, downplayed the change, which was reportedly made under pressure from conservative forces in the country, saying that sexual minorities would still be protected under a category of other grounds.
Elsewhere in Europe, lawmakers in heavily Roman Catholic Portugal approved marriage equality legislation in a required second vote this week. President Aníbal Silva, himself a practicing Roman Catholic, must give final approval. He's a member of a leading conservative PSD party, which has opposed marriage equality. But Silva hasn't publicly commented on the issue. Analysts believe that even if he vetoes the measure, there are enough votes in Parliament for an override. Portugal's Parliament passed the bill in a first vote in January, but rejected proposals to allow same-gender couples to adopt. According to local media, government authorities and Roman Catholic leaders want the matter resolved before the planned visit to Portugal by Pope Benedict XVI in May. If the bill is ratified, Portugal will join five other European nations, Belgium, Sweden, Spain, the Netherlands, and Norway, to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. Civil partnerships, generally granting most of the rights of marriage except the name, are open to lesbian and gay couples in Britain, France, and Germany.
After more than 17 hours of emotional debate over two succeeding days, described variously as insult-laden and colorful, lawmakers in the Australian state of Queensland, by a vote of 48-40, approved a measure on February 11th to eliminate criminal sanctions for altruistic non-commercial surrogacy. In other words, a woman can agree to carry a child as long as she isn't being paid to do so. Commercial surrogacy continues to be illegal in the state. The legislation also allows the transfer of legal parentage from the surrogate to a single person or same-gender couple that commissioned the birth. Most opposition MPs said they would have backed the bill if same-gender couples had been specifically excluded. Opposition frontbencher Ray Hopper argued that the measure would see same-gender parents using babies like pets to gain popularity and would lead to confusion at public toilets. Such statements prompted Premier Anna Bligh of the ruling Labour Party to label those in opposition rednecks. But she also emphasized that there were no plans to change state laws to open adoption to same-gender couples. Queensland is the last Australian state to decriminalize altruistic surrogacy, which had been punishable by a $10,000 fine or 3 years in prison.
Rights for same-gender couples were also hotly debated in a few of the 50 U.S. states this week. Lawmakers in both Iowa and New Hampshire, where legal civil marriage is already open to gay and lesbian couples, rejected measures to constitutionally ban them. A Maryland House committee refused to approve a bill earlier this month that would have banned same-gender marriage and denied recognition to same-gender couples legally married elsewhere. And a proposed constitutional amendment to ban same-gender marriage is currently stalled in a West Virginia House committee, but it has the support of both the majority and minority leaders. Meanwhile, a bill that would have protected state workers from discrimination based on sexual orientation died in a Virginia House of Delegates subcommittee this week, just one day after such protections passed the Senate for the first time.
And finally, a column in the San Francisco Chronicle this week essentially outed Chief U.S. District Judge Vaughn Walker, who's presiding over the high-profile federal court case challenging the constitutionality of California's Proposition 8. The column said that many gay politicians in San Francisco and lawyers who have had dealings with Walker say the 65-year-old jurist, appointed to the bench by Republican President George H.W. Bush in 1989, has never taken pains to disguise or advertise his orientation. The religious right and their media mouthpieces immediately demanded that Walker recuse himself from the case. National Organization for Marriage Director Brian Brown said the judge had been an amazingly biased and one-sided force throughout this trial, far more akin to an activist than a neutral referee. But as a private attorney in the early 1980s, Walker was assailed by LGBT activists for representing the U.S. Olympic Committee in a successful bid to keep what was called the first gay Olympics in San Francisco from infringing on its name. As a result, they've since been called the Gay Games. An editorial in the Chronicle following the outing column supported Walker's impartiality, pointing out that he almost lost his chance to reach the federal bench because of claims that he was anti-gay and hostile to civil rights. Two dozen House Democrats, led by Nancy Pelosi, who's now House Speaker, had opposed his nomination. The New Yorker and Washington Post published similar editorials endorsing Walker's impartiality. He's currently studying some 12 days of evidence and testimony in the case before he hears closing arguments. That's not expected to happen for at least a few more weeks. Whatever Walker's decision in the non-jury trial, his ruling is certain to be appealed and is likely to eventually reach the U.S. Supreme Court. Proposition 8 supporters are almost sure to cite Walker's sexual orientation in their appeals if he rules against them.
That's News Wrap for the week ending February 13th, 2010. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. You can read the text of this week's News Wrap online at www.thiswayout.org. For This Way Out, I'm Pam Marshall.
And I'm Rick Watts.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine brought to you by you. Your charitable donations keep this program on the air. We've produced some special CDs to say thank you to our supporters, featuring queer history, reviews of LGBT music, and behind-the-scenes looks at relevant movies and TV shows. You can also now get CDs of our regular program by subscription, and be sure you never miss a week of This Way Out. For all the details, please visit our website at thiswayout.org.
Embedded lesbian ministers find plenty of grist for their documentary mill, and a lesbian poet laureate is remembered later in the program. The time has come for The Hour Between, a new novel from Allison Books by Sebastian Stewart. This Way Out commentator Janet Mason says this unusual coming-of-age story is a true literary gem.
I stumbled across gay writer Sebastian Stewart's new novel, The Hour Between, quite by accident, and was delighted to discover a writer with an authentic and original voice. The Hour Between is a coming-of-age story about a gay teenager and his best friend, a girl named Katrina, in the setting of a Connecticut boarding school known for being liberal, artsy, and most crucial for having a lenient admissions policy. The story begins when the protagonist, Arthur, is well into midlife, living in San Francisco, the place that he moved to 40 years ago, and writes that he is enraptured with still. Arthur received a call from his old classmate, Jeffrey, who also lives in San Francisco, with news about Katrina, who has not been heard from since their last year in boarding school, and who reportedly has been living in Europe. Arthur remembers that Jeffrey had been an effeminate bone skinny boy and was a bone skinny man with a long thin head and a milky spot in one pupil that I'd always found touching. His effeminacy had aged into a distinguished rectitude. Connecting the present to the past, Stewart goes back in time, embarking on a story of the protagonist's last year in boarding school. The year was 1967. It was 1 year before the assassination of Martin Luther King, and protest against the war in Vietnam was at full throttle. Arthur is coming of age in a time of drugs, which he reluctantly experiments with. Political discourse, they agree the Vietnam War is immoral and that Martin Luther King is their hero, and sexual experimentation. But the larger issue is his intimate friendship and love for Katrina, described as equal parts elf, urchin, enfant terrible. She was the most adorable thing I'd ever clapped eyes on. Arthur is still struggling with his sexuality. Nonetheless, Katrina immediately identifies him as gay after she tells him about her actress mother. "Don't tell me you adore her. All gay boys adore mummy. You should see them at parties and openings. It's moss to a flame." To which Arthur responds, "Just like that, tossing it off, she pegged me for gay. I mean, I knew I was no John Wayne, but was it that obvious?" Arthur describes his experience of being gay as a big ball of confusion, shame, and semen. All I really knew for sure was that I had longings for other boys, and I wanted to be honest about it, both with the world and with myself. Nonetheless, when Arthur goes to see a psychiatrist, it is not out of concern with himself, but because he wants advice on how to help Katrina, who seems to be on the edge of a brilliant acting career, but in reality is teetering on the brink of a nervous breakdown. The story of Arthur's last year in boarding school, when he is accepted by a college in San Francisco, comes to its inevitable conclusion, and the epilogue brings the reader back full circle to the narrator's adult life 40 years later. Stewart's deft writing demonstrates that when our stories marinate in time, they gain in stature and significance. From the vantage point of perspective, the narrator writes of Katrina as a person who changed his life, even though he was never to see her again. She had reached out to me that year and pulled me out of myself, shown me how to love, and I loved her still. The hour between is the kind of writing that is an honoring, underscored by emotional honesty that rings true, even if it is a fiction. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Audre Lorde, poet, activist, and educator, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Audre Lorde was born in 1934 in Harlem. As a child, she became immersed in poetry, at times speaking in poetry. As a black lesbian, her poetry often expressed longing for justice in a world dominated by white heterosexual males. In 1968, her first book, titled The First Cities, was published. And during a six-week writer-in-residence position at Tougaloo College, she met Frances Clayton, her longtime partner. In 1971, Ms. Magazine published a lesbian love poem by Audre Lorde. After two more decades of prolific writing, she was given the Walt Whitman Citation of Merit and was appointed Poet Laureate of New York State. She often said, "I am a black lesbian feminist," and at other times said, "I cannot be categorized." Her life and legacy prove both statements true. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Reverend Robin Gorsland.
I'm Kate Clinton, and while I can joke about the political state of our country, an informed community is a strong community. That's why I'm inviting you to tune in to this station to hear This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine.
Come. Thank God for the day we wrote, in God we trust on our dollars. Hum, hum.
Thank God for the airwaves overrun with Christian scholars.
A unique documentary film premieres in Tucson, Arizona this month. Faith of the Abomination features lesbian ministers Seal Melton and Han Nguyen, who infiltrate an Austin, Texas evangelical megachurch. They pose as heterosexually married evangelists from Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam. In the course of their elaborate investigation, Han and Seal uncover a plan by the pastor to swindle his congregation. This Way Out correspondent King David McKenzie had a chance to speak with the women about their film.
Was the initial root of this concept for the film, you know, aside from watching Candid Camera way back when? Let's face it, that's where the real...
That's where it started, didn't it? Yeah, it did. I think the initial root started for this idea when we invested a year in a mainstream Pentecostal church as lesbian ministers. And we met with the senior pastor on a regular basis in his office. He kept assuring us that we're welcome in that church, but we were never called on to minister or even take part in any kind of function.
And he would tell us in private that, you know, he had to clear it, so to speak, with the leadership of the church, because his fear was if he let us be active in the church as ministers, that somehow it would convey the message to the congregants that they accept our...
or condone our lifestyle.
Our homosexual lifestyle.
Yeah.
Right.
Quote, unquote.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Gotcha.
When he finally told us after a year investing in that church, going and supporting the numbers, and he told us from his pulpit, he looked right at us, he did not call our names, but we knew. If we wanted to minister and work in that church, all we had to do is come to the altar that very moment, that morning, that Sunday morning, repent for what I think is being who we were created to be, that God would change our DNA and we'd no longer be homosexual. Well, you know, that just kind of threw us for a loop.
Which way are you looking? Is it hard to see? Do you say what's wrong for him is not wrong for me? You walk the streets of righteousness, but you refuse to understand. Say you love the baby, then you crucify the man. Say you love the baby, then you crucify the man.
So we left that church. We knew. We tried to give him the benefit of the doubt and make contact with him. No return calls. They just totally ostracized us, and we haven't talked to the man since.
Mm-hmm.
That's what gave me the idea that if we changed our outside packages, we go in as ministers in a mainstream Pentecostal church, an evangelical church, we change our outside package and go as man and wife, we wouldn't have that problem, even with the same minister's credentials. I changed my outside package. I became a man with male pattern baldness, dressed as a man. I already knew the protocol for the evangelicals. My father was a minister for all my informative years growing up. My father pastored a Pentecostal church, and I consider that part of my heritage.
Right.
And I just think it's unfair that every time I go in an evangelical church, I have to listen to the word abomination from these people.
Right.
Because who I was created to be. And that's where the idea came from. And that's what we did. We developed characters.
It was kind of a theory. You know, we were guessing that if we looked different and if we looked the way that was acceptable to them as a heterosexual couple,
right,
that we would be able to get in and they would get to know us.
Now where was this church, the first church?
The first church was in Austin, Texas, and also the second church that we went to after we changed our outside appearance and our looks and became what they perceived as a heterosexual couple. Their website was hooked up to all the political hate groups that hate the homosexuals and gays and transgenders. And
right.
I want our people to be able to go into a mainstream church and not sit there on pins and needles afraid they're going to hear that they're an abomination or they're of the devil or several different phrases the mainstream churches use. It's time for that to stop. Because we do subsidize their taxes when they're starting to get the teach their small children. They have a private school there in this second church that we went in as CL and Cammy. They teach their kids at a young age that we're abominations. And also, we subsidize their tax so they can start teaching their hate at a young age.
Right.
For our people. And enough's enough. We got emails from the pastor and his wife of this second church for CL and Cammie. We set up a email account for CL and Cammie, and we got emails. We were taken to lunch, and we got emails of how they're connected to us spiritually. And that was the message going in for us. Mm-hmm. If we could change the outside baggage, get them to stop with their hate rhetoric long enough, worship with us, and when they found out the real me, the seal, the minister seal, that they would take that into account by connecting to the Spirit of God inside me. Well, that did not happen. As soon as we came out on that Sunday morning in front of the whole congregation, after the minister had paraded us in front of that church and used us for months.
That was King David McKenzie in conversation with Han Nguyen and Seal Melton about their documentary, Faith of the Abomination. You can find more information about the film online at faithoftheabomination.com. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Pam Marshall, Rick Watts, Lucia Chappell, Janet Mason, Judd Proctor, and Brian Burns with Reverend Robert Gorslein, Kate Clinton, and King David McKenzie contributed program material. Thanks also to Chris Wilson, Pink Floyd, Sweet Honey in the Rock, Jim Croce, and the Five-Man Electrical Band performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is only made possible by our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, listen to our podcasts, read the text of this week's news wrap, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KRZA, Alamosa, Colorado, CFRC, Kingston, Ontario, WDIY, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Well, we have some people to thank. Brian?
Yes, Brian. Yes. Let's know.
We have longtime listener Jim, who donated in the last break. Mary and Scott.
Scott is a long-time contributor to KPFT. Long time. He is a wonderful community person, and I really thank you for your generosity. Everybody who has...
We thank everybody, but we need more. I mean,
we're about halfway there for tonight, but we need more. Let's you know, we're halfway through the show.
Exactly. What a coincidence. And make those phones ring, 713-526-KPFT.
Oh, and remember that part of what we're contributing here goes to if you set things up the way we were talking about earlier, that part of 10% of the pledge goes to the Doctors Without Borders, Partners in Health, and MECC, that's the Multi-Ethnic Community Center, as well as in honor of the 40th year, $5 if instead of the normal $35.
Am I supposed to say that?
Yeah, I guess it would be. It is our fund drive.
It's a standard pledge. But
yeah, instead of the standard pledge, an extra few dollars goes to directly to the Haiti Fund.
We know it's times are tough out there,
yeah.
and it's not easy to be asking for money at this time, but it is important that we're still a voice. We're still the independent voice here in Houston, Texas. Air America went down the drain. Liberal radio just doesn't seem to work commercially, so we're very lucky to have a Pacifica station here in Houston. It's one of the only five in the country. This is a station where you hear lots of different things about different things, from the environment to talking about different parts of the community. Where else are you going to hear that? We're asking you, please, pledge to KPFT, KPFT Houston. It's a Pacifica Foundation station. Queer Voices has been here since 1993, and we're asking you for your help. You're listening to Queer Voices.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
This is a song that says, I ain't afraid of your Yahweh, I ain't afraid of your Allah, I ain't afraid of your Jesus, but I'm afraid of what you do in the name of your God. And it's kind of saying, yes, religion and culture is fabulous, it's wonderful, it's the glue that holds a lot of people together, but be careful. It's like that Dylan song with God on your side. If you start committing genocide and raping and pillaging under the name of your God, then that's religion run amok.
Welcome to Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and I can hardly believe it, but this is my 10th anniversary show. I wanted to make it special, and I don't think I could have done any better than to bring you an interview with Holly Neer. If you know anything at all about the women's music movement, then you know that Holly was one of the leading and earliest pioneers. And this show will just scratch the surface regarding her long career. A career that encompasses her work as a singer, producer, actor, author, activist, and teacher. There's a very interesting quote on her website that I think sums up well her approach to her art. She says, "I do not separate my music from my heart, nor do I separate my ideas from my daily life. I open myself up to learning as much as I can about humanity and this mysterious life experience. But I do not relate to political work as a series of causes. Moment by moment, I integrate what I learn into my personal life, personalizing my politics. It is from this personal place that I write my songs. Well said. I started this show with a very outspoken song called I Ain't Afraid. That's from her CD called Edge from 2000. And when I asked her what songs she is most known for, that's one she mentioned right away. I want to interject that in 10 years, I've interviewed a lot of artists, and when I was editing this interview, I just marveled at how good her comments are. It was an editor's dream. I had to cut almost nothing, and it's all so good. I'm delighted to share this with you. As there was so much, the interview will be presented in two parts, with, as always, the first hour being presented as a part of Queer Voices on KPFT. And both parts can be heard on my site at www.queermusicheritage.com. With such a long career covering so many aspects, I decided I would just try to cover a number of her songs and to let them take us through the years and tell the story. So this will be roughly chronological. She started her own record label, Redwood Records, and released her first album in 1973. But I've got one song to play that precedes what we talked about, and she's probably going to visibly flinch when she finds out I'm playing this next song. It was done about 3 years earlier. Her professional career really started in 1969, when she got acting parts in several television shows and movies, and even on Broadway. That was in the cast of the musical Hair. In 1970, she was briefly a member of a comedy troupe called First National Nothing. Another well-known member of that cast was Barry Bostwick. To me, it's a bit hard to believe that Columbia Records released a soundtrack for that show called If You Sit Real Still and Hold My Hand, You Will Hear Absolutely Nothing. On the record, Holly sings lead on two of the songs. This is probably the first time this song has been heard on the radio, and that's probably a good thing. But I love historical obscurities, so I can't resist sharing just a little bit of what is, as far as I know, her first recorded song. It's called On the Moon.
Aren't you kind of happy that we're here in the stars? When we're on the moon, when we're on the moon. Aren't you kind of happy that you're here, here in my arms? When we're on the moon, when we're on the moon. Like to look at the smile. Don't forget that I tried just to get you a while. Love to get you inside. Need you here by my side. I like to look at your smile. Don't forget that I tried.
Wop a wop a wop a
wop. You know what? There are two more verses, but I think you have the idea. And I'd rather get to the part where I get to ask Holly to discuss particular songs. The earliest one I asked her to talk about was the title track from her 1976 album, You Can Know All I Am.
When I was first writing songs, I had just come back from a trip in the Pacific to Okinawa, Japan, Hiroshima, Hawaii, where soldiers were resisting war and racism from within the military, and it was a huge education for me. I came back from that trip, and I started writing political songs. Very outspoken political songs, using words like genocide in the song No More Genocide, talking about what was happening in the U.S. war against Indochina. So to counterbalance some of that, because I wanted people to know it was not just I was not just coming from a rhetorical place, but a personal place, I also tried to write some personal songs that when I was singing to the audience that they would invite them in to me a little bit. And You Can Know All I Am was one of the songs where I tried to step outside of global political issues and sing something that was very personal and intimate.
You can know all I am. Share my life, take my giving. I can't change how I'm living, but you can know all I am. take my love, I am willing. I can't change how I'm living, but you can know all I am.
Please tell me about the song, Imagine My Surprise.
When I first started working with women musicians in California predominantly, it was relatively new. I mean, we would try to go to this club, the Troubadour in Los Angeles. Chris Williamson and I tried, Wendy Waldman and I tried to do a joint concert there, and they said, oh, well, two women can't do a show together. It has to be like a male comic or guitar player. And we said, why? And they said, well, it'll be competitive, you know, like who would go first? And we would laugh and say, well, we'll figure that out. It's not competitive. So eventually, Chris Williamson and I finally got them to agree to let us do a joint concert. I mean, it's shocking now looking back. It was like a struggle. So I was working with these women, and Meg Christian and Margie Adam and Linda Tillery, and it was just slowly dawning on me, not only was I falling in love with women in general because of the feminist movement, I was falling in love with a particular woman, and this had not been part of my upbringing. I had not identified as a lesbian growing up, even secretly or privately. So Imagine My Surprise was kind of a way of not only saying I was in love with one woman, but that I was in love with women, that feminism had taken me out of this self-hating journey that so many of us were on, and celebrated that woman-loving. And the different verses tried to call on the discovery of who we are as women, both in a big universal way as well as very personally. And it was true. I was surprised, and that imagine my surprise, this was happening to me.
Imagine my surprise. I love that I found you, but I ache all over wanting to know your every dream. Imagine my surprise.
Rugged women have gone before me. other voice you heard on that song was the person she was talking about, Meg Christian. And I also asked about a song they wrote together called Nina.
When I began writing outspoken lesbian songs, I tried, because of my global work, because I was a global peace activist, I think my take on lesbian songs was slightly different than people who had come to their politics through their sexuality. And Nina was identifying, one, that not all lesbians were white and middle class, and second, that that there were a group of women who had really struggled early on in the transitioning from totally being in the closet to being out. And women who had done that journey, it had been very painful to be in the closet, maybe in being married, being in relationships, but knowing you were in love with the woman next door, going to the bars, which were oftentimes owned by the mafia, being in the military and being hounded, all these different things. That transitionary generation really had taken some hits. But I wanted to give a nod to that and then also allow this mother to feel so much joy that because of the work she did and her generation did, her daughter was going to be able to love freely. And I think that song was very successful in that regard. It was it's a very sweet song.
In Amazon battles, I rode like a lady, except when alone. I wept for dead soldiers and burned all my journals. Oh, Nina, where does your heart take you today? To play with Negra and Rose and Maria. I sadly recall the friends of my childhood. My love. Shining as you dance with each other. I wore shiny stockings. I was led to the floor. I learned how to follow, but never got married. Oh, Nina. Your laughter, your lovers, your courage to feel. I was never allowed to love Eloisa, yet you sleep so warm in the arms of your friends. But as I lie awake and hear your soft pleasure, my resentment fades and I shelter your love. For the outside world makes you cry all too often.
Up next is another of Holly's most powerful and most known songs, which is, I think, a celebratory anthem. It also first appeared in 1976 on the Imagine My Surprise album, and is called Something About the Women.
The women's movement, the feminist movement, and which was also very closely linked to the lesbian feminist movement, we were trying to investigate all the things that affect women's lives. And as a result of that, we learned about disability. We learned about alcoholism and drug abuse in our community. We learned about spirituality and religion. We learned, you know, all racism. The things that go on the world on a global level all, of course, affect women. So at first it was this kind of enthusiasm coming out of the predominantly white middle class women's movement about this new feminism. But those of us who had worked in world politics very quickly realized that to have a powerful feminist women's movement, we would need to expand to be a global movement and have a global consciousness. So that song came out of wanting to create a song that could, where different verses could be added again and again and again about the various things that affect women's lives, always coming back to the refrain, there's something about the women in our lives.
We are going to interrupt this wonderful segment that JD's doing to remind you that we are asking you to help us out here. Help us out and pledge to KPFT. We ask you, as we're all volunteers here on this show, Queer Voices. This is a show for and about the GLBT community. And even if you're not part of the community, I hope you realize the value of what this show does and the other shows here on KPFT in serving the local community. You go up and down the radio dial and you'll hear lots of other stuff, but how much stuff is really about the local angle? What's going on in your backyard? What's going on in your city? KPFT does bring the local perspective here, and it's a very important institution here in Houston, serving Houston, the surrounding area. We hope that you feel that this is important to you. So please call us at 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT.
And we want to thank our last two guests. They both, when they left the mics, went out and pledged. Tracy, thank you. Marion, thank you so much for not only coming on the show, but your generous donation.
We have one volunteer out there waiting for the phones to ring, so make her do... be out there volunteering for a purpose. The number is 713-526-KPFT.
We're very close to our goal tonight. We need a
we're
couple
inches
more,
away.
We need a couple more people, please. It's the management likes to see us when we make our goal. It means a great deal more than you can ever imagine. So please, if you've got a few moments, pick up the phone, 713-526-5738, and pledge.
She's the mother of my youth. She's the daughter of my...
going to chime in that if you ask me to suggest just one album by Holly for you to buy, for me, as a champion of women's music, I would have to pick a double CD from 2000 called Simply Love. It's subtitled The Women's Music Collection and includes many of the songs I ask Holly to talk about. And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along, while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more Very Queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. Over the years, Holly has sung and recorded frequently with Ronnie Gilbert, and that included an album in 1983 called Lifeline. Holly captured every element I hoped she would when I asked her about the song Perfect Night.
Perfect Night is kind of a nod to the transition of the sort of dark, deep, secretive gay bar scene that men and women, and women in particular, had to suffer in the 50s and 60s before there was a lesbian movement, before there was a feminist movement. And there was role-playing. You had to sort of pick whether you were going to be butch or femme. There was a kind of danger. Some of the clubs were owned by the mafia. If women from the military were there, oftentimes there were raids and they had to be snuck out the back. I mean, it was quite a traumatic time. So this song was kind of a breakout from that to really say we're out, we're in public, we're having a perfect night together, and there's not shame attached to it and there's not fear.
Woman is dressed in style tonight. She's got a three-piece suit and a tie tonight. There's a polished glow on her face in spite of her look of amusement. And she will dine with her true love, taking a bar or two. And nothing short of a perfect night will do. The gal is dressed for dusty jeans and some boots tonight. There's a lover's look on her face in spite of her farming intentions. And she will plant with her true love, take a break in the barn, maybe two. And nothing short of a perfect night will do. The jock is dressed in wool tonight. She's got a baseball glove, a cap. Gentlemen asks, are you ladies alone? They smile and say, no, we're together. The lady is dressed in silk tonight. She's got a glittering gown, a stole tonight. There's a sequin on her cheek in spite of her sparkling eyes. And she will dance with her true love, put on a show or two. And nothing short of a perfect night, nothing short of a perfect night. When the gals are out, don't you know that it's true? Nothing short of a perfect night will do.
It was once only dining and dancing, evening kisses, morning smiles.
Then you said, let's go off together, alone for a while. And I loved you at first for your wicked eyes and the laughter that loosens your bones and your soft curls and the passions that I've never known. My love was love of the moment, of the strangeness, the thrill. But moments deny tomorrow, and yet I love you still. Well, it seems like so little was spoken about ending the games. We just kept waking up, kept waking still together, up,
together,
and feeling the change.
Please tell me about Valentine's Song. I'm looking at the Chris and Holly album in that regard.
Mae Christian wrote a beautiful love song called Valentine's Song, and she, you know, she was part of the really early women's music when there was a period of time where women were writing songs that were singing them that were coded. Like she might be in a club, you know, a little club in Washington, singing "Sherry Baby," and having to pick songs out of pop and rock music that would suggest that she was woman identified but wouldn't really come out because it was still too dangerous. But when that transition happened and she could, with the support of the newly developed women's movement and lesbian movement, could actually start writing love songs to women, I just think this was a spectacular first song out there that she wrote. It's very, very beautiful. In fact, I remember when we were doing the California tour with Meg and Chris and Margie and myself, one of the cities we did, was a women's prison, because we wanted to do one show inside because those women couldn't come out to the concert. So when Meg sang that, I was standing in the wings, and one of the prison guards, a woman, was standing there, and I said, oh my God, when she sings this, they're going to kick us out. You know, it's going to be the end of it. And instead, the guard was sitting there swaying, and she said, oh, the girls are going to love this one. Just like, whoa, okay. And it was just a beautiful moment. So when Chris and I decided to do a recording together, we just couldn't resist singing Valentine songs.
Holly Near and Chris Williamson, and from their duets album from 2000 called Chris and Holly, that was Valentine's Song. That song was written and sung by Mae Christian in 1974 on her album I Know You Know, the first album released on the Olivia Records label. Another very prominent song of Holly's is Simply Love. It's been recorded by many gay and lesbian choruses, and it's one of my favorites. She released it on her 1984 album, Singing With You, the song Simply Love.
When I was traveling around the country and the world, I saw how much fear there was around issues of gay and lesbian lifestyle and culture. And people, see, I was raised in a family that said, go for fascination before you go for fear. See if there's a way to just go, wow, huh, you live on the planet too. So that was and because of the records, if you remember records, we had so many records in our house, on our farm, that came from different parts of the world. And it really helped us open our hearts up to all the diversity of this species, this animal that we are. But I would see around gay issues, because I worked in the global peace movement, and I would just see fear, and misunderstanding and mistrust. And so I wanted to write a song that spoke to people who were still being oppressed by their fear, to say to them, it's simply love. It's simply love. And I used that song to sing in places where the gay and lesbian movement had not yet made inroads. And it was sometimes very frightening to sing the song. But it was a great handle for me. It was a way to talk about this, to sing it to people, and hope that the song would invite them through some of their trauma so that they could move to being more conscious and loving and tolerant people.
Why does my love make you shift restless in your chair and leave you in despair? It's simply love. It's simply my love for a woman. It's a simple hand on a warm face to say a glance to see if love is still okay. A glow at dawn when love is still there. Tears and strong arms at the end of the day. And simply love. Simply my love for a woman. It's the laughter as the kids clown and tease our weary thoughts away. It's looking round the table and knowing a hard work fed us one more day. And simply love. Simply my love for a woman. Why does my love make you shift in your chair? It's the bombs across the border that should make you tear your hair. And yet it's my love leaves you screaming out your nightmare. Perhaps you know there's something you should fear. If my love makes me strong and makes you disappear, it's simply love. Simply my love for a woman.
I want to chime in that picking what songs to cover and also what to put in this first hour was very difficult. We're talking about a career starting about 40 years ago, covering 27 albums and appearances on a number of albums by other artists. She was very gracious to allow me to ask her about 25 different songs. Covering many of the highlights on this segment certainly does not take away from the other interesting stories, so I hope you also listen to part two on my site. I had no trouble, however, in wanting to include one of her latest recordings, a new song inspired by recent politics. It's called When We Meet in the Middle.
Recently in California, as many people know, there was a huge financial and political attack on gay marriage in San Francisco, which had been such a joyful and fun and wonderful thing. And all of a sudden, it was just like they turned all the guns towards California. And in the process, the right to marry in California was attacked and ultimately lost. So there will be more legal and electoral responses to this for sure. But while that was happening, there was going to be a big march taking place in Fresno. And in California geography, Fresno is in the middle of the state, so that people from Los Angeles and San Francisco could converge, as well as people from all the other parts of the state. And they decided to have it there, and they were calling it Meet in the Middle. So I wrote a song for that event. But the whole idea was a sort of twofold. One, Meet in the Middle geography for all the activists, and the other is around any subject that is complex. Is there a way for progressive communities to come together, and even if they're not in agreement on all things, they can in some way find a way to meet in the middle around issues of race and gender, sexuality, class, around immigration, all the things that we should be taking to heart? How can we find some common ground and look at all these issues together rather than as separate? You know, there was a time, I think, in the 60s and early 70s where a kind of separatism was important, because, and almost every social change group has it, whether it's the deaf community, the African American community, the lesbian community, when you're trying to figure out who you are, you sometimes have to separate long enough to get someone's foot off your neck and say, okay, how can I think clearly without feeling so oppressed? But once that clear thinking comes in, to me, we go back into the middle. We don't stay out in a separatist place. That maturity takes us back into a state of coalition with other people. And if gay people who are working on gay marriage only stay working on gay marriage, then they're ignoring the fact that there are gay people in the black community, in the Middle East community, in the disabled community, that you have to go and be part. I mean, gay people are not just in a gay movement. We are everywhere around the world. So it leads me to feel like the gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual, queer community will do much better if we can have a global perspective and invite people from all walks of life into our movement. And when I say our, I mean, the fact is I'm not a lesbian in my life right now, but I think of it as our because I think of anti-racism is our, and I'm a white person. I think of stopping abuses against disabled people as ours, and I'm not disabled. I have joined a global community that is ours. And so Meet in the Middle was trying to speak to that.
No group can make it if we go it alone. We're building the changes stone by stone. Not in agreement on all things of the heart, but when we meet in the middle, it's a powerful start. Let's hold up the spirit across the board, not just for those who can afford to advertise their hate and fear. But no matter what they do, our love is still here. No group can make it if they go it alone. We're building the changes stone by stone. Not in agreement on all things of the heart, but when we meet in the middle, it's a powerful start. Love is love, and hate is hate. And on that point, there is no debate. Don't ask, don't tell is the great pretender. Elvis sang it right, he said, a love be tender. No group can make it if they go it alone. We're building the changes stone by stone. Not in agreement on all things of the heart, but when we meet in the middle, it's a powerful start.
lift the veil of that right-wing shame. Equality in marriage and in freedom's name. No breaking windows, no burning down parks. That's not where this fire sparks. Hanging in there can be a heavy load. From slavery to White House is a long, long road. No group can make it if they go it alone. We're building the changes stone by stone. Not in agreement on all things of the heart, but when we meet in the middle, it's a powerful start. No group can make it if they go it alone. We're building the changes stone by stone. Not in agreement on all things of the heart, but when we meet in the middle, it's a powerful start. When we meet in the middle, it's a powerful start.
Again, that was When We Meet in the Middle, which you can download for free on her website, www.hollynear.com. And while this next question was the last one I asked Holly, I loved her reply, so wanted to share it with you in this first segment. Is there any question I should have asked you that I haven't?
Oh, probably. When one has worked as long as I have in this movement, I mean, I started singing when I was 8 years old, and then I went to UCLA, and then I got into film and television, and then I started doing social change activist work. And so I would say I've been singing in public for 52 years, 60 now, and one accumulates so many experiences over that time that in any interview, there's always lots that will get left out. But that's okay. It's been an extraordinary life, and I would say to any of the young people listening that activism needs to be demystified. One doesn't have to chain oneself to the gate at the White House to be called an activist. It is the way we get up every morning, the way we treat our loved ones, the way we look at the people in our workplace. Do we honor them and respect them? How do we respond if we're at a party and we hear a racist joke? Do we do intervention? In walking down the street and we see a sad teenager, do we look them in the eye and say hello? Activism is how we get up every morning. And the music that I am part of and that hundreds of social change activist artists around the world are part of is trying to identify what is unique and special about our lives as well as what is universally applied, so that we can document this extraordinary experiment of being on this planet. It's the only planet we know of that has life on it like this, and we get to be here, and to be an artist in this time is a great honor as well as a huge challenge.
We're down to the last song for this part, and I want to thank you all for listening and helping me to celebrate my 10th anniversary show. And, of course, I especially want to thank Holly Near for making this month's show extra special. Again, there's much more to the interview on my website at www.queermusicheritage.com. And, as always, if you have questions or comments, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. And please check out my new show called Out Radio. It celebrates new music by GLBT artists and is at www.outradio.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. The last song is called Singing for Our Lives, and it's one of Holly's most loved songs, and it's taken on anthem qualities. She's recorded it a number of times, but I chose a version taken from her 1983 album, Lifelines, which captured a concert she did with Ronnie Gilbert.
I wrote Singing for Our Lives after Harvey Milk and Mayor Moscone were assassinated in San Francisco. And I can remember it being sung at many events, but the thing that always moved me so was these people would put up their lighters, their candles, and there were people in the street singing this song, the first verse of which is, "We are gay and lesbian people," were saying those names about themselves for the first time. They were being very brave and coming forward. And trying to take the rage and the hurt of the city as a result of Harvey being killed, trying to take that anger and direct it towards a social change movement so that something could be built rather than something destroyed. And the song flew out around the world. People kept adding verses. The Irish and English women sang it when they were trying to work for peace in Ireland and England, and it was sung in a prison in Latin America. I keep hearing all these stories of where the song had traveled. And so allies began to change the verse to "We are gay and straight together." And eventually the song made it into the Unitarian hymnal. So it's become kind of a peace anthem, a gay and lesbian anthem, and an anthem that allies and gay people can sing together. In fact, oftentimes in the concerts when I start to sing that song, people stand and take hands and sing it together as a real glue in their community, which is very moving to me. Eventually, we learned a lot more about sexuality. So now I can't fit all the different identities that we have into the meter of the song. It's just impossible. Transgender and queer and questioning. And so now I've added a verse that says we are all in this together singing for our lives.
We are a gentle angry people.
been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 9 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Brian Levinka, Jennifer Renee, and Jack Valensky, with contributing editors Joan Devlin in Iowa and David Elliott in Washington, D.C. The music heard on this program is provided by J.D. Doyle, who also contributes to the audio file.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.